21.
Mouth at the worm's ear, Father said, "We have loved each other well, dear Willie. But now, for reasons we cannot understand, that bond has been broken. But our bond can never be broken. As long as I live, you will always be with me, child." Then let out a sob. Dear Father crying. That was hard to see. And no matter how I patted and kissed and made to console, it did know. "You were a joy," he said. "Please know that. Know that you were a joy. To us. Every minute, every season, you were a... You did a good job. A good job of being a pleasure to know. Saying all this to the worm, how I wished him to say it to me, and to feel his eyes on me. So I thought, all right, by Jim, I will get him to see me. And in I went. It was no bother at all. Say, it felt all right. Like I somewhat belonged in there. Held so tight. I was now partly also in Father, and could know exactly what he was, could feel the way his long legs lay, how it is to have a beard, taste coffee in the mouth, and, though not thinking in words exactly, knew that the feel of him in my arms has done me good. It has. Is this wrong? Unholy? No, no, he is mine. He is ours. And therefore I must be, in that sense, a god in this. Where he is concerned, I may decide what is best. And I believe this has done me good. I remember him. Again. Who he was. I had forgotten somewhat already, but here, his exact proportions, his suit smelling of him still, his forelock between my fingers, the heft of him familiar from when he would fall asleep in the parlor, and I would carry him up to, it has done me good. I believe it has. It is secret, a bit of secret weakness that shores me up. In shoring me up, it makes it more likely that I shall do my duty in other matters. It hastens the end of this period of weakness. It harms no one. Therefore, it is not wrong, and I shall take away from here this resolve. I may return as often as I like, telling no one, accepting whatever help it may bring me, until it helps me no more. Then Father touched his head to mine. Dear boy, he said, I will come again. That is a promise.
22.
After perhaps 30 minutes, the unkempt man left the Whitestone home and stumbled away into the darkness. Entering, I found the boy sitting in one corner. "My father," he said. "Yes," I said. "He said he will come again," he said. "He promised." I found myself immeasurably and inexplicably moved. "A miracle," I said.
23.
At approximately 1 a.m. tonight, per this report, Pres Lincoln arrived at front gate requesting he be allowed to enter same accordingly,
and not knowing what else to do given his position, which is president, not an inconsiderable position for him to have, or anyone, I did allow him entry, even though, as you know, Tom, protocol states once gate locked is not to be unlocked, until such time as unlocking is scheduled, to wit, morning. But since it was Prez himself asking, was a bit of a horn dilemma staring in my face, and also, I was somewhat groggy at being late, as mentioned above, and having given myself over yesterday to some fun in the park with my own children, Philip, Mary, and Jack Jr., thereby being somewhat tired, and I admit dozing a bit at your desk, Tom. Did not question Prez as to what he was doing here or something like that. Only when our eyes met, he gave me such a frank, friendly, somewhat pained look, as if to say, "Well, friend, this is rather odd, I know it, but with eyes so needful, I could not refuse him. As his boy is just today interred, so you might well imagine how you or I might act or feel in a similar sad spot, Tom. If your Mitchell or my Philip, Mary, or Jack Jr. was to expire, well, no use thinking of that." Had no driver with him, but had arrived alone on small horse, which I was quite surprised at him being Prez and all, and say, his legs are quite long and his horse quite short, so it appeared some sort of man-sized insect had attached itself to that poor unfortunate nag, who, freed of his burden, stood tired and hangdog and panting, as if thinking, "I will have quite the story to tell the other horsies upon my return, if they are still awake," at which time Prez requested key to Carroll Crypt, and accordingly I handed it over and watched him wander off across grounds, wishing I'd had courtesy at least to offer him loan of lamp, which he did not have one, but went forth into that Stygian dark like pilgrim going forward into a trackless desert, Tom. It was awful sad. Tom, here's the strange part. He's been gone for ever so long. He's still gone as I write. Where is he, Tom? Lost? Is he lost? Lost in there, or fell and broke something, lying there, crying out? Just now stepped out, listened, no cries. Where is he at this time? Do not know, Tom. Maybe out there in woods somewhere, recovering from visit, indulging in solitary cry.
In Watchman's Logbook, 1860-78, Oak Hill Cemetery, entry by Jack Manders, night of February 25th, 1862. Quoted by arrangement with Mr. Edward Sansibel. 24.
It would be difficult to overstate the vivifying effect this visitation had on our community.
Individuals we had not seen in years walked out, crawled out, stood shyly wringing their hands in delighted incredulity.
Individuals we had never seen before now made their anxious debuts.
Who knew Edenston to be a tiny man in green, wig askew? Who knew Cravwell to be a giraffe-like woman in spectacles, holding a book of light verse she had written?
Flattery, deference, smiles, ringing laughter, affectionate greetings were the order of the day.
Men milled about under that high February moon, complimenting each other's suits, enacting familiar gestures, kicking at the dirt, throwing a stone, feigning a punch. Women held hands, faces upturned, calling one another lovely and dear, pausing beneath trees to exchange strange confidences withheld during many years of seclusion.
People were happy. That was what it was. They had recovered that notion.
It was the idea, the very idea that someone...
From that other place?
That someone from that other place would deign to...
It was the touching that was unusual.
It was not unusual for people from that previous place to be around.
Oh, they were around often enough.
With their cigars, wreaths, tears, crepe, heavy carriages, black horses stamping at the gate.
Their rumors, their discomfort, their hissing of things having nothing at all to do with us.
Their warm flesh, steaming breath, moist eyeballs, chafing undergarments.
Their terrible shovels laid carelessly against our trees.
But the touching? My God!
Not that they didn't sometimes touch us.
Oh, they'd touch you, all right. They'd wrangle you into your sick box.
Dress you how they wanted you, stitch and paint you as necessary.
But once they had you how they wanted you, they never touched you again.
Well, Ravenden...
They touched Ravenden again.
But that sort of touching.
No one wants that sort of touching.
The roof of his stone home was leaking. His sick box had been damaged.
They hauled it into the daylight, threw open the lid.
It was autumn, and leaves were falling all over the poor fellow. Proud type, too, banker. Claimed to have owned a mansion on the...
They yanked him out of the box and dropped him, thump, into a new one. Then asked in jest, had it hurt? And if so, did he wish to file a complaint? Then they enjoyed a lengthy smoke. Poor Ravenden, half in and half out, head tilted at a most uncomfortable angle, calling out feebly all the while for them to kindly place him in a less unseemly...
That kind of touching.
No one wants that.
But this was different.
The holding, the lingering, the kind words whispered directly into the ear. My God, my God.
To be touched so lovingly, so fondly, as if one were still...
Healthy.
As if one were still worthy of affection and respect. It was cheering. It gave us hope.
We were perhaps not so unlovable as we had come to believe.
25.
Please do not misunderstand. We had been mothers, fathers, had been husbands of many years, men of import, who had come here that first day, accompanied by crowds so vast and sorrowful that, surging forward to hear the oration, they had damaged fences beyond repair. Had been young wives, diverted here during childbirth, our gentle qualities stripped from us by the naked pain of that circumstance, who left behind husbands so enamored of us, so tormented by the horror of those last moments. The notion that we had gone down that awful black hole, pain-sundered from ourselves, that they had never loved again, had been bulky men, quietly content, who, in our first youth, had come to grasp our own unremarkableness and had cheerfully, as if bemusedly accepting a heavy burden, shifted our life's focus. If we would not be great, we would be useful, would be rich and kind, and thereby able to effect good. Smiling, hands in pockets, watching the world we had subtly improved walking past, this empty dowry filled, that education secretly funded, had been affable, joking servants of whom our masters had grown fond for the cheering words we managed as they launched forth on days full of import, had been grandmothers, tolerant and frank, recipients of certain dark secrets, who by the quality of their unjudging listening granted tacit forgiveness and thus let in the sun. What I mean to say is we had been considerable, had been loved. Not lonely, not lost, not freakish, but wise, each in his or her own way. Our departures caused pain. Those who had loved us sat upon their beds, heads in hand, lowered their faces to tabletops, making animal noises. We had been loved, I say, and remembering us, even many years later, people would smile, briefly gladdened at the memory.
And yet?
And yet no one had ever come here to hold one of us while speaking so tenderly.
Ever.
26.
Before long, a sea of us surrounded the Whitestone home.
And pushing forward, pressed the boy for details. How had it felt being held like that? Had the visitor really promised to come again? Had he offered any hope for the alteration of the boy's fundamental circumstance? If so, might said hope extend to us as well?
What did we want? We wanted the lad to see us, I think. We wanted his blessing. We wanted to know what this apparently charmed being thought of our particular reasons for remaining.
Truth be told, there was not one among the many here, not even the strongest, who did not entertain some lingering doubt about the wisdom of his or her choice.
The loving attentions of the gentleman having improved our notion of the boy, we found ourselves craving the slightest association.
With this new established prince.
Soon the line of people waiting to speak to the lad ran down the path as far back as the tan sandstone home of Everfield.
27.
I will be brief.
Jane Ellis.
I doubt it.
Mrs. Abigail Blass.
Mrs. Blass, please, everyone will get a—
Once at the Christmastide, Papa took us to a wonderful village festival. Ugh.
Please don't crowd. Simply stay in line. All will be accommodated.
She yips and yips and must always be first in all things. How? Please tell me, does she merit such—
You could learn a thing or two from her, Mrs. Blass. Look at her posture.
How calm she remains.
How clean her clothing is kept.
Gentlemen, if I may. Once at the Christmastide, Papa took us to a wonderful village festival. Above a meat shop doorway hung a marvelous canopy of carcasses. Deer with the entrails pulled up and out and wired to the outside of the bodies like tremendous bright red garlands. Pheasants and drakes hung head down, wings spread by use of felt-covered wires, the colors of which matched the respective feathers. It was done most skillfully. Twin pigs stood on either side of the doorway with game hens mounted upon them like miniature riders, all of it bedraped in greenery and hung with candles. I wore white. I was a beautiful child in white, long rope of hair hanging down my back, and I would willfully swing it, just so. I hated to leave, and threw a tantrum. To assuage me, Papa bought a deer and let me assist him in strapping it to the rear of the carriage. Even now I can see it. The countryside scrolling out behind us in the near evening fog, the limp deer dribbling behind its thin blood trail, stars blinking on, creeks running and popping beneath us as we lurched over groaning bridges of fresh-cut timber, proceeding homeward through the gathering.
Ugh.
I felt myself a new species of child, not a boy, most assuredly, but neither a mere girl. That skirt-bound race perpetually moving about serving tea had nothing to do with me. I had such high hopes, you see. The boundaries of the world seemed vast. I would visit Rome, Paris, Constantinople. Underground cafes presented in my mind where, crushed against wet walls, a handsome, generous friend and I sat discussing many things. Deep things, new ideas. Strange green lights shone in the streets. The sea lapped nearby against greasy, tilted moorings. There was trouble afoot, a revolution into which my friend and I must... Well, as is often the case, my hopes were not realized. My husband was not handsome and was not generous. He was a bore. Was not rough with me, but neither was he tender. We did not go to Rome, or Paris, or Constantinople, but only back and forth, endlessly, to Fairfax, to visit his aged mother. He did not seem to see me, but only endeavored to possess me, would wiggle his little roach of a mustache at me whenever he found me, as he so often found me, silly. I would say something that I felt had truth and value in it regarding, for example, his failure to get ahead in his profession. He was a complainer, always fancying himself the victim of some conspiracy who, finding himself thus disrespected, would pick some trivial fight and soon be sacked. But he need only wiggle that mustache and pronounce mine a woman's view of the thing, and that was that. I was dismissed. To hear him bragging about the impression he had made on some minor functionary with a witty remark, and to have been there and heard that remark and noticed the functionary and his wife barely able to refrain from laughing in the face of this pompous little nobody was trying. I had been that beautiful child in white, you see, Constantinople, Paris, and Rome in her heart, who had not known at that time that she was of an inferior species, a mere woman. And then, of an evening, to have him shoot me that certain look, I knew it well, that meant, "Brace yourself, madam, I will soon be upon you, all hips and tongue," little mustache having seemingly reproduced itself so as to be able to cover every entry point, so to speak. "And afterward I will be upon you again." Fishing for a compliment was more than I could bear. Then the children came. The children, yes, three marvelous girls. In those girls, I found my Rome, my Paris, my Constantinople. He has no interest in them at all, except he likes to use them to prop himself up in public. He disciplines this one too harshly for some minor infraction, dismisses that one's timidly offered opinion, lectures loudly to all regarding some obvious fact.
You see, girls, the moon hangs up there among the stars,
as if he has just that instant discovered it. Then glances around to judge what effect his manliness is having on passers-by.
If you please, many are waiting.
Is he to care for them? In my absence? Catherine is soon to begin school. Who will make sure her clothes are correct? Mary Beth has a bad foot and is self-conscious and often comes home in tears. To whom will she cry? Alice is nervous, for she has submitted a poem. It is not a very good poem. I have a plan to give her Shakespeare to read and Dante, and we will work on some poems together. They seem especially dear to me now, during this pause. Fortunately, it is a minor surgery only. A rare opportunity, really, for a person to pause and take stock of her...
Mrs. Ellis was a stately, regal woman, always surrounded by three gelatinous orbs floating about her person, each containing a likeness of one of her daughters. At times, these orbs grew to extreme size and would bear down upon her and crush out her blood and other fluids as she wriggled beneath their terrible weight, refusing to cry out as this would indicate displeasure. And at other times these orbs departed from her, and she was greatly tormented and must rush about trying to find them, and when she did, would weep in relief, at which time they would once again begin bearing down upon her. But the worst torment of all for Mrs. Ellis was when one of the orbs would establish itself before her eyes exactly life-sized, and become completely translucent, and she would thus be able to mark the most fine details of the clothing, facial expression, disposition, etc. of the daughter inside, who, in a heartfelt manner, would begin explaining some difficulty into which she had lately been thrust, especially in light of Mrs. Ellis's sudden absence. Mrs. Ellis would show the most acute judgment and abundant love as she explained, in a sympathetic voice, how the afflicted child might best address the situation at hand. But alas, herein lay the torment, the child could not see or hear her in the least, and would work herself before the eyes of Mrs. Ellis into ever-increasing paroxysms of despair, as the poor woman began to dash about, trying to evade the orb, which would pursue her with what can only be described as a sadistic intelligence, anticipating her every move, thrusting itself continually before her eyes, which, as far as I could tell, were incapable, at such times, of closing.
On other days, everyone she met manifested as a giant mustache with legs.
Yes, her way is hard.
Not so hard. She's a rich one. You can tell by her voice.
Young sir, may I ask? A kindness?
Snooty.
If you are allowed back to that previous place, will you check Catherine's clothing and console Mary Beth and tell Alice it is not a sin to fail in one's first attempt? Assure them I have been thinking of them since I arrived here and am trying to make my way home, and that even as the ether was administered, I was thinking of them and only...
Take the money, I said. I am calm.
Mr. Maxwell Boys.
Again pushed aside? Because I am small?
Perhaps it is because you are so dirty.
I live close to the ground, sir, as I believe you...
Your slippers are absolutely black with filth.
Take the money, I said. I am calm. You will also, sir, please, remain calm, I said. We have no enmity between us of which I am aware. Let us regard this as a simple business transaction. I will hand you my wallet, just so, and then, with your permission... Beyond my... No. Entirely the wrong and illogical thing for you to... Low stars, blurred rooftops, and I am punctured.
Try now, Mrs. Blass.
Mrs. Blass, notoriously frugal, filthy, gray-haired and tiny, smaller than a baby, spent her nights racing about, gnawing at rocks and twigs, gathering these things to her, defending them zealously, passing the long hours counting and recounting these meager possessions.
The opportunity to finally address the lad, there in front of that festive crowd, struck that diminutive lady with a sudden case of stage fright.
You have $1,300 in the first bank, I believe?
Yes. Thank you, Reverend. I have $1,300 in the first bank. In an upstairs room I will not specify, I have 4,000 in gold coin. I have 2 horses and 15 goats and 31 chickens and 17 dresses, worth in total some $3,800. But am a widow. What seems like abundance is in fact scarcity. The tide runs out but never runs in. The stones roll downhill but do not roll back up. Therefore, you will understand my reluctance to indulge in wastefulness. I have over 400 twigs and nearly 60 pebbles of various sizes. I have 2 dead bird parts, dirt motes too numerous to count. Before retiring, I count my dead bird parts, twigs, pebbles, and motes, rending each with my teeth to ensure all are still real. Upon waking, I often find myself short several items, proving the presence of thieves and justifying those tendencies for which many here, I know they do, judge me harshly. But they are not old women, menaced by frailty, surrounded by enemies, the tide going only out, out, out.
So many were still waiting, a shifting mass of gray and black, as far as the eye could, people in the moonlight outside pushing and shoving, standing on tiptoe to see me. Faces thrusting into the doorway to blurt their sad this or that. None were content. All had been wronged, neglected, overlooked, misunderstood. Many wore the old-time leggings and wigs and...
When in my merry red jacket of velvet I moved past flower-bright hedges in the full flush of my youth, I cut a fine figure indeed. All who saw thought well of me. Men of the town would stutter upon my approach. My shards would step aside, awed as I passed. This is what I should like the young swain to know. And many was the time I pounded my lust out in the night to good result, pounding my good wife, or, if she was indisposed, pounding my shards, whom I called shards, for they were, indeed, dark as night, like unto so many shards of coal, which did give me abundant heat. I need only seize a shard lass up, and ignoring the cries of her shard man would...
Good Lord!
He is in fine form tonight.
Bear in mind, Lieutenant, he is but a child.
And 'twas a goodly thing to so diminish that shard man in the eyes of the others. And this message going round, their behavior was improved. And the next working day, even the most behemoth of those shards would lower his eyes, for it was I who held the whip and the pistol, and each shard knew that were he to offend me, that night would be costly to him, and my fee for his offense would be that one most dear to him, and I would kick open his door and drag his lass out and remove her to my quarters, and the evening's entertainment would commence, and that shard would be made to give off sparks. Consequently, my fields were quiet, and when any order was given, a dozen pair of hands rushed to fulfill it, even as those yellow, weary eyes glanced up to see, did I note it, and would I excuse them and theirs from my pleasure? In this way, I converted shard to ally, and made them foes to one another.
Lieutenant Cecil Stone.
During these confident, aggressive episodes, fueled by these boastful assertions, Lieutenant Stone's bodily mass would be swept upward into an elongate, vertical body coif. His body volume remaining constant, this increase in height would render him quite thin, literally pencil-thin in places, tall as the tallest of our pines. When finished speaking, he would resume his former proportions, becoming again a man of average size, beautifully dressed, but with terrible teeth.
Young sir, if we may approach, the little lady and me?
Eddie Barron.
No. I'm afraid that will not be possible at this—
Fuck that!
Betsy Barron.
Everyone gets a turn, you said.
We was low and fell lower. That's the main thing we wanted.
We didn't even bother bringing our nice shit into that shithole by the river. After the Swede kicked us out of the place on G.
We couldn't even fit that fucker, that beautiful couch, through the shitty little door of that shithole by the river.
I do not even consider that shitty little door of that shithole by the river a door. When I think of that fucking door we had on G, what a door. The door on that shithole by the river would have been ashamed to call itself a door if it ever saw that fucking magnificent door on G. Still, we had our fun.
By the river.
Everybody soused and throwing each other into the fucking drink, with lit stogies and all, and Chinooski kept trying to pronounce Potomac.
Everybody heaving stones at them washer ladies.
Remember when what's-his-name Tintini almost drowned? Then, when Colonel B revived him, first thing Tintini did was ask for his fucking mug of punch.
Perhaps that is enough, the Reverend said coldly.
Remember that time we left little Eddie at the parade ground?
After the poke, what do you call it?
We'd had a few.
Didn't hurt him.
Might have helped him.
Made him tougher.
If a horse steps on you, you do not die.
You might limp a bit.
And after that, be scared of horses.
And dogs.
But wandering around in a crowd for 5 hours does not kill you.
What I think, it helps you. Because then you know how to wander around in a crowd for 5 hours without crying and panicking.
Well, he cried and panicked a little once he got home.
Ah, sweet Christ. You protect the goddamn little fuckers from everything. Next thing, they're calling you to the privy to wipe their assholes. One thing I'll say for Eddie Jr. and Mary Mag, they always wipe their own assholes.
And we didn't have no privy.
Just shit wherever.
Why don't they ever come see us? That's what I want to know. How long we been here? A pretty fucking long time, and they never once—
Fuck them. Those fucking ingrate snakes have no goddamn right to blame us for a fucking thing until they walk a fucking mile in our goddamn shoes. And neither fucking one of the little shitheads has walked even a shitting half mile in our fucking shoes.
Enough, said the Reverend.
These were the Barons.
Drunk and insensate, lying in the road, run over by the same carriage, they had been left to recover from their injuries in an unmarked, disreputable, common sick pit, just beyond the dreaded iron fence, the only white people therein, thrown in with several members of the dark race, not one among them, pale or dark, with a sick box in which to properly recover.
It was not quite comme il faut that the Barons should presume to speak to the boy.
Or be on this side of the fence.
It is not about wealth.
I was not wealthy.
It is about comportment. It is about, let us say, being wealthy in spirit.
The Barons, however, came and went as they pleased, the fence not being an impediment to them.
As in that previous place, they remained unconstrained.
Ha!
Ha ha!
The Barons were followed in rapid succession by Mr. Bunting. I certainly have nothing of which to be ashamed. Mr. Allenby, I came to this here town with $7 stitched in of my pants and do not intend to go any damn place until someone tell me where in hell is my dollars. And Mrs. Proper Fesbit, I request one last hour during which the terrible pain be not upon me, so that I may bid farewell to my dear ones in a more genial spirit, who inched up to the doorway, frozen in the same crabbed, fetal posture in which she had spent her last bedridden year in that previous place.
Dozens more still excitedly waited to speak with the lad, buoyant with new hope.
But alas, it was not to be.
28.
Presently, we became aware, by way of certain familiar signs, that trouble was brewing.
It happened as it always happens.
A hush fell across the premises.
The scraping of winter branches against winter branches could be heard.
A warm breeze arose, fragrant with all manner of things that give comfort. Grass, sun, beer, bread, quilts, cream. This list being different for each of us, each being differently comforted.
Flowers of extraordinary color, size, shape, and fragrance sprang forth, fully formed from the earth.
The gray February trees began to blossom.
Then yielded fruit.
Fruit responsive to one's wishing. Only let the mind drift in the direction of a certain color, silver, say, and shape, star. And of the instant, a bounty of star-shaped silver fruits would sag the limbs of a tree that seconds before had stood fruitless and winter dead.
The paths between our mounds, the spaces beneath trees, the seats of the benches, the crooks and limbs of the trees themselves, in short, every available inch of space, became spontaneously filled, then overfilled, with food of every variety, in pots and upon fine plates, on spits run between boughs, in golden troughs, in diamond tureens, in tiny emerald sauce bowls.
A wall of water rushed in from the north, then divided itself with military precision into dozens of sub-streams, such that each stone home and sick mound soon had its own dedicated tributary. The water in these tributaries then rather flamboyantly converting itself into coffee, wine, whiskey, and back into water again.
All of these things we knew, the fruited trees, the sweet breeze, the endless food, the magical streams, comprised merely the advance guard, so to speak, of what was coming.
Of who was coming?
Sent by them to exert a softening effect.
We steeled ourselves accordingly.
It was best to roll into a ball, cover the ears, close the eyes, mash the face into the earth, thereby plugging the nose.
Strength now, all, shouted Mr. Volman.
And they were upon us.
29.
They entered in lengthy procession.
Each of us apprehending them in a different guise.
Young girls in summer dresses, brown-skinned and jolly, hair unbound, weaving strands of grass into bracelets, giggling as they passed. Country girls, joyful and gay. Like me, like I had been.
A swarm of beautiful young brides arrayed in thinnish things, silk collars fluttering.
Angels, attentive to strangely corporeal wings, one large wing per woman, that upon retraction became a pale flag, tightly furled, running down the spine.
Hundreds of exact copies of Gilbert, my first, my only lover, as he had looked on our best afternoon in the carriage house, gray horse towel wrapped carelessly about his waist.
My girls, Catherine, Mary Beth, Alice, multiple duplicates of each, going along hand in hand, hair up in Trenton braids, each wearing her last Easter dress and holding a single sunflower.
A greeting party of shard lasses, arrayed in the crude smocks they favored, fallen off their shoulders in deliberate sluttiness, didst come forth to grovel before me. But I had seen and defeated their ilk many times before, and did now leave a generous brown turd for their gift, and retreated me home to await their departure.
The brides moved stealthily, like hunters, seeking for any sign of weakness.
"Where is my dear reverend?" the lead angel called, her voice redolent of the fragile glass bells we had always rung upon Easter Sunday.
One of the multiple Gilberts came over and, kneeling beside me, asked would I kindly unstop my ears and just please look at him. Something in his voice made it impossible to disobey. He was beautiful beyond measure. "Come with us," he whispered. "Here it is all savagery and illusion. You are of finer stuff. Come with us, all is forgiven." We know what you did, said a second Gilbert. It is all right. I did not do it, I said. It is not complete. It is, the first Gilbert said. I may yet reverse it, I said. Dear boy, said the second. Soften, soften, said a third. You are a wave that has crashed upon the shore, said a fourth. Kindly don't bother, I said. I have heard all of this. Let me tell you something, said the second Gilbert harshly. You are not lying on any floor in any kitchen, are you? Look around, fool. You delude yourself. It is complete. You have completed it. We say these things to speed you along, said the first.
One of the country girls was Miranda Deb, sitting there, real as dirt beside me, as of yore, legs crossed under the faded yellow skirt she used to favor. Only she seems so big now compared to me, like a regular giant. You are in a tough spot, sweet Abigail, aren't you? She said. Often, upon waking, you find yourself short several items, don't you? Come on. Come with us. We're here to set you free. Look at our arms, our legs, our smiles. Are we liars? Who look so healthy? And who've known you so long? Do you remember hiding of a summer day in the hayrick? Your mother calling for you? Digging in then, delighted to be hiding. It is that times 1,000,000 where we will take you, said another, who I now recognize as none other than my dear bridesmaid, Cynthia Hoynton.
Eddie, ain't that fucking Queenie? My Betsy says to me. And sure enough it was. Queenie be one of the sluts from Purdy's, who'd give you a good frontal bend down. Maybe it's time to give it up, Skipper, Queenie said. In a pig's ass, I said. Eddie, said Betsy. Fuck off, I said. I know what I'm about. What are you about, Queenie said. The hell with you, I said. I believe your wife may feel differently, she said. She don't, I said. Fuck off, we travel together. I wonder, she said. Betsy's eyes were cast down. Good girl, I said. Keep 'em down. Then she can't fucking fuck with you. We aren't here to fuck with anyone, Queenie said. Do the bend down, I said. Anytime you want us, she said to Betsy. Call out. Off you go, I said, cock teaser.
At one moment, the angels stepping en masse back into a ray of moonlight to impress me with their collective radiance, I glanced up and saw, spread out around the white stone home, a remarkable tableau of suffering. Dozens of us frozen in misery, cowed, prone, crawling, wincing before the travails of the particularized onslaught each was undergoing.
Abby, dear, said Miranda Deb, allow me to show you something. And put her hands on either side of my face. And I saw where they wanted to take me. The tide would run in and never out. I would live atop a hill and the stones would roll up. When they got to me, they would split open. Inside each was a pill. When I took the pill, I had, oh, glory, all I needed. For once in my life. Miranda dropped her hands from my face and I was just back here again. Did you like that? Miranda said. Very much, I said. Come with us then, said her friend, who I saw was good old Susanna Briggs, binding her hair up in a cloth, long grass blade in her mouth. Two others were playing tag in a gully. Was it Adela and Eva McBain? It was! Some cows were gazing at the tag game with love. It felt funny the cows could love, but that was just the kind of world it was with these sweet girls around. I can't believe you are an old widow, said Miranda Deb. And so little, said Susanna Briggs. You, who was always so pretty, said Miranda Deb. You had it rough, said Cynthia Hoynton. The tide ran out but never ran in, said Susanna Briggs. The stones rolled downhill but never rolled back up, said Cynthia Hoynton. You never in your life was given enough, said Miranda Deb. My eyes teared up. That is so true, I said. You are a wave that has crashed upon the shore, said Miranda. We say these things to speed you along, said Susanna. I said I didn't know about any of that, but sure would fancy another of those pills. Come with us then, Miranda said. The McBaines in the gully paused to listen, as did the cows, as did, somehow, the barn. I was so tired, and had been tired for ever so long. I believe I will come with, I said.
From off to my left came a shout. Of terror or victory, I could not be sure. Followed by the familiar yet always bone-chilling fire sound associated with the matter-light-blooming phenomenon. Who had gone? I could not tell, and was still too under siege myself to care.
As if stimulated by this victory, our tormentors now redoubled their efforts.
Rose petals rained down, a joyful provocation, red, pink, yellow, white, purple. Then translucent petals, striped petals, dotted petals, petals inscribed, when you took one from the ground and looked closely at it, with detailed images down to the broken flower stems and dropped toys of one's childhood yard. Finally, golden petals rained down, of real gold, ticking with each impact against tree or marker stone.
Then, singing. Beautiful singing. Filled with longing, promise, reassurance, patience, deep fellow feeling.
It affected one deeply.
You wanted to fucking dance.
But you also wanted to fucking cry.
While dancing.
Mother came. About 10 of her. But none smelled the least like Mother. Say, what is that trick? To send a lonesome fellow 10 false mothers. Come with us, Willie, one mother said. But then, all of a sudden, they did smell right, very right, and cuddled in around me, smelling right. Mother, my goodness, good old. You are a wave that has crashed upon the shore, said a second mother. Dear Willie, said a third. Dear, dear Willie, said a fourth. And all of those mothers loved me so, and wanted me to go with, and said they would take me home, soon as I was ready.
When will you know the full pleasures of the marriage bed? When behold Anna's naked form? When will she turn to you in that certain state, mouth hungry, cheeks flushed? When will her hair, loosened in a wanton gesture, fall at last around you? Thus spoke Elsbeth Grove, my wife's cousin, or rather spoke a deceiving creature fashioned into the exact image of Elsbeth, in a thinnish thing, silk collar fluttering. I'll tell you when, said a second bride, whom I now recognized as my own dear grandmother, also arrayed disconcertingly in a thinnish thing, collar fluttering. Never. That's finished now. You delude yourself, Kugel. Since their last visit, they had somehow acquired my nickname. It troubles Anna that you remain here, Elsbeth said. She asked me to relay this message. I was weakening with every second, and knew I must rally some defense. Is she there now, I said, waiting for me, in that place to which you so eloquently urge me to go? I had them now, for though they are happy enough to deceive, they prefer not to lie. Elsbeth, blushing, cast an anxious glance at grandmother. It is rather difficult to answer your question, Elsbeth said. You are demons, I said, who assume these familiar forms to lure me thither. My, but you are honest, Kugel, said grandmother. Are you so honest regarding your own situation, said Elsbeth. Are you sick, Kugel, said grandmother. Do doctors put sick people into sick boxes? I do not recall that practice ever being followed in our time, Elsbeth said. Therefore, what must we conclude, Kugel? Said Grandmother. What are you? Where are you? Admit it, dearest. Believe it. Say it aloud. Profit by it. Join us. We say these things to speed you along, said Elsbeth. And I saw that I must apply the ultimate antidote. To whom do you speak? I said. Who is hearing you? To whom do you listen? Whose hand do you now follow, as it lifts to point to the heavens? What is the source of the voice causing those looks of consternation to appear even now upon your faces? Here I am. I am here. Am I not? This had its usual effect. Confused and deflated, the brides huddled, whispering to one another, devising a new plan of attack. Fortunately, at that moment, their fraudulent conference was disrupted by the sound of two more distinct and separate fire-sound, matter-light-blooming occurrences, one from the south, one from the northwest.
Eddie took off running at them sounds. Sometimes he gets pretty fucking scared of shit. One of them sluts came right up to me. Then I seen it is not a slut, but our own daughter, Mary Mag. All fucking dressed up, finally come to visit after all these fucking years of not. Mother, she said, we are sorry to have been so remiss, Everett and I. Who's Everett? I said. Your son, she said. My brother. Edward, you mean? I said. Eddie? Eddie Jr.? Edward, yes, correct, sorry, she said. Anyway, we should have come a long time ago, but I have been quite busy being successful and loved and producing many children of surpassing beauty and intelligence, as has Everett. Edward, I said. Edward, yes, she said. I am just so exhausted from all my successes. Well, that's all right, I said. You're here now, kid. And Mother, she said, please know, everything is all right. You did the best you could. We blame you for nothing. Although we know that you feel you may have at times exhibited certain defects of maternal... I was kind of a shit mother, wasn't I? I said. Whatever failures you feel you may have been responsible for, leave them behind you now, she said. All turned out beautifully. Come with us.
Come where, though, I said. I don't...
You are a wave that has crashed upon the shore, she said.
See, I don't get that, I said. Just then, Eddie came racing back. My hero! Ha! Huh. Clear the fuck out of here, you, he said. It's Mary Mag, I said. No, it ain't, he said. Watch this! He picked up a stone and shagged it. Right at Mary Mag. As the stone passed through, she was not Mary Mag anymore at all, but I don't fucking know who or what. Some blob or blast of sun in the shape of a goddamn dress.
You, sir, are a fool, the light blob said. Then it turned to me. You, madam, it said. Are less so.
The lead angel took my face into her hands as her wing swished back and forth, putting me in mind of a horse's tail as that animal feeds. "Are you thriving here, Reverend?" she said, wing extended lazily above her. "Is he whom you served in life present here?" I believe he is," I said. "He is, of course, everywhere," she said, "but does not like to see you lingering here among such low companions." Her beauty was considerable and increasing by the second. I saw I must end our interview or risk disaster. "Please go," I said. I do not require you today." "But soon, I think," she said. Her beauty swelled beyond description, and I burst into tears.
As abruptly as it had begun, the onslaught now ended.
As if upon some common signal, our tormentors departed, their song turning somber and mournful.
The trees went gray in their wake. The food vanished. The streams receded. The breeze fell. The singing ceased.
And we were alone.
And all was dismal again.
30.
Mr. Volman, Reverend Thomas, and I went forth immediately to determine who had succumbed.
The first had been the frugal Mrs. Blass.
Scattered around the surface of her home place were her treasured dead bird parts, twigs, motes, et al., now unattended, objects of value no more.
A.G. Coombs, it appeared, had been the second to succumb.
Poor fellow. None of us knew him well. He had been here many years, but only rarely left his sick box.
And when he did, was always heard to bark, "Do you know who I am, sir? They hold me a table at Binlay's. I wear the Legion of the Eagle." I still recall his shock when I told him I did not know of that place. "Binlay's is the finest house of the city," he exclaimed. "Of what city?" I inquired, and he said, "Washington," and described the location of that place, but I knew that intersection, and it was most decidedly a place of stables, and I told him so. "I pity you," he said, but I had shaken him. He sat a while on his mound, pensively stroking his beard. "But surely you know the esteemed Mr. Humphreys," he thundered. And now he was gone. "Goodbye, Mr. Coombs, and may they know of Binlay's wherever you are bound."
We wandered past many sitting dejectedly upon their mounds or the steps of their stone homes, weeping with the effort of resistance. Others sat quietly sorting through the various seductive visions and temptations to which they had lately been exposed.
I felt a renewed affection for all who remained.
Wheat had been separated from chaff.
"Our path is not for everyone. Many people, I do not mean to disparage them, lack the necessary resolve."
"Nothing matters sufficiently to them. That is the thing."
Unsure of who the third victim had been, we suddenly remembered the lad.
It seemed unlikely that one so young could have survived such a merciless assault.
This being the desired outcome.
Given his youth.
The alternative being his eternal enslavement.
We found ourselves in a saddened but relieved state of mind as we set off to confirm his departure.
31.
Imagine our surprise when we found him sitting cross-legged on the roof of the white stone home.
"Still here?" Mr. Volman said in amazement. "Yes," the lad answered dryly.
His appearance was startling.
The effort of resistance had cost him dearly.
"These young ones are not meant to tarry."
He was out of breath. His hands were shaking. He had lost, by my estimation, approximately half his body weight. His cheekbones protruded. His shirt collar hung huge about his suddenly stick-like neck. Charcoal dark rings had appeared under his eyes, all of these combining to give him a peculiar wraith-like appearance.
He had been a chubby boy.
But was chubby no longer.
"Good God," Mr. Bevins whispered.
It had taken the trainer girl nearly a month to descend to this level.
"The fact that you are still here is impressive," the Reverend said to the lad. "Heroic, even," I added. "But ill-advised," said the Reverend.
"It is all right," Mr. Volman said gently. "Really, it is. We are here. Proceed in peace. You have provided us ample hope that will last us many years and do us much good. We thank you. We wish you well. We bless your departure."
"Yes, only I am not going," the boy said.
At this, the Reverend's face registered a degree of surprise even more pronounced than the usual considerable level of surprise recorded there.
"Father promised," the boy said. "How would that be if he came back and found me gone?" "Your father is not coming back," said Mr. Volman. "No time soon, anyway," I said. "At which point you will be in no condition to receive him," said Mr. Volman. "If your father comes," the Reverend said, "we will tell him you had to leave. Explain to him that it was for the best." "You lie," the boy said. It appeared the boy's degradation had now begun to affect his disposition. "I beg your pardon," said the Reverend. You three have lied to me from the first, the boy said. Said I should go. What if I had? I would have missed Father entirely. And now you say you will give him a message? We will, the Reverend said. We most certainly. But how will you? The boy said. Have you a method of communication? I did not when I was there within him.
We do, said Mr. Holman. We do have such a method.
Nebulous, far from established.
There has historically been some confusion around this issue.
Just then, from across the premises, came the sound of Mrs. Delaney calling out for Mr. Delaney.
Many years ago, her husband had preceded her to this place, but was no longer here. That is to say, though his sick form lay just where she had put it, Mr. Delaney himself
was elsewhere.
Had gone on.
However, poor Mrs. Delaney could not resolve to follow.
Because of some funny business that had taken place with another Mr. Delaney.
The brother of her husband.
It had not felt funny at the time, but urgent, faded, and wonderful.
But now she was of a divided heart. Having spent many years in that previous place, longing for this other Delaney, miserably trapped in her marriage.
She had, within a month of her husband having come here, taken up with that other Delaney, only to find him at once falling in her estimation, because of the reckless disregard he had shown for her husband's, his brother's, memory. This revealing to her that he was of a decayed and avaricious moral character, unlike her husband, who had been, she now saw, upstanding in every way.
Albeit rather literal and timid, and not nearly the imposing and alluring physical specimen that he, the morally suspect brother, was.
So she found herself stuck.
Physically longing for that Delaney, still back there, in that previous place.
But also desiring to go and see her husband again and apologize.
For having wasted the many years of their life together, craving another man.
In short, she did not know whether she was coming or going.
Going or waiting.
So just wandered around shouting, Mr. Delaney!
Continuously.
We never knew which Delaney she was calling for.
Nor did she.
I say, the lad suddenly gasped, an unmistakable quaver of fear in his voice.
Looking over, my heart sank. The roof around him had liquefied, and he appeared to be sitting in a gray-white puddle.
From out of the puddle, a vine-like tendril emerged.
Thickening as it approached the boy, it flowed, cobra-like, over the juncture at which his calves crossed.
Reaching to brush it away, I found it stiff, more stone than snake.
A chilling development.
The beginning of the end.
32.
If Miss Traynor's case was any indication, this tendril would soon be followed by a succession of others until the boy was fully secured, Gulliver-like, to the roof.
Once secured, he would be rapidly overgrown by what might best be described as a placental sheen.
This sheen then hardening into a shell-like carapace, that carapace would begin to transition through a series of others, viz., the fallen bridge, vulture, dog, terrible hag, etc., each more detailed and hideous than the last, this process only serving to increase the speed of his downward spiral. The more perverse the carapace, the less light, happiness, honesty, positive aspiration would get in.
Driving him ever further from the light.
These memories of Miss Traynor depressed us.
Bringing to our minds, as they did, the shame of that long-ago night.
On which we had abandoned her.
Stumbling away, heads lowered.
Tacitly assenting to her doom.
As she descended.
We remembered her singing merrily all through the initial carapacing, as if to deny what was happening.
A heavy bough hung down.
Dear child.
Lovely voice.
Which became steadily less lovely as the initial carapace formed and she took on the form of a girl-sized crow.
Cawing out a nightmarish version of that tune.
Flailing at us whenever we drew too near, with one human arm and that tremendous black wing.
We had not done enough.
Being rather newly arrived back then.
and much preoccupied with the challenges of staying.
Which were not inconsiderable.
And if not lessened in the meantime.
My opinion of myself fell somewhat on that occasion.
Yes.
The chapel bell now tolled three.
Jolting us back to the present, producing its usual strange, discordant aftertone.
Selfish, selfish, selfish.
The chief, too, of Mr. Bevan's eyes widened, as if to say, "Gentlemen, it is time to go."
And yet we lingered, brushing away such tendrils as appeared.
The lad had fallen silent.
Turned inward.
Fading in and out of consciousness.
Mumbling and tossing, apparently lost in some delirious dream.
"Mother," he whispered.
33.
Mother says I may taste of the Candy City, once I am up and about. She has saved me a chocolate fish and a bee of honey. Says I will some day command a regiment, live in a grand old house, marry some sweet and pretty thing, have little ones of my own. I like that. All of us will meet in my grand old house and have a fine. I will make the jolliest old lady, Mother says. You boys will bring me cakes round the clock while I just sit. How fat I will be. You boys must buy a cart and take turns wheeling me around. Mother has such a nice way of laughing. We are on the third stair step. Stair step number three, that has three white roses on it. Here is how it goes from stair step number one to stair step number five, the number of white roses. 2, 3, 5, 2, 6. Mother comes in close, touches her nose to mine. This is called knee-knee, which I find babyish, but still I allow it from time to. Father comes along, says, "Say, can I get in on this pile-up?" He can. If Father puts his knees on stair-step number two and stretches, he can reach with his fingers to stair-step number 12. He is that long. Has done it many times. No more pile-ups, unless I am strong. Therefore I know what I must stay. Is not easy, but I know honor. Fix bayonets. How to be brave is not easy. Remember Colonel Ellis, killed by Rebs, for bravely tearing down the Reb flag from a private. I must stay, if I wish to get home. When will I? When may I? Never if weak. Maybe if strong.
34.
The boy's eyes flew open.
"Strange here," he said. "Not strange," said Mr. Bevins, "not really." "One gets used to it," said the Reverend. "If one belongs here," said Mr. Bevins, "which you don't," said the Reverend.
Just then, three gelatinous orbs floated past, as if seeking someone.
And we realized that Mrs. Ellis had been the third of us to succumb.
The orbs were now empty, i.e., contained no daughters.
They paraded sourly by, seemed to glare at us, drifted away down the steep incline to the creek, became dimmer, finally vanished entirely.
"Not strange at all," said Mr. Bevins, blushing slightly.
35.
and there came down upon us a rain of hats.
Of all types.
Hats, laughter, crude jests, the sound of fart noises made by mouths from on high. These were the harbingers of the approach of the three bachelors.
Though only they among us could fly, we did not envy them.
Having never loved or been loved in that previous place, they were frozen here in a youthful state of perpetual emotional vacuity, interested only in freedom, profligacy, and hijinks, railing against any limitation or commitment whatsoever.
We're all for fun and jollity, distrusted anything serious, lived only for their rollicks.
Their boisterous cries often resounding above our premises.
Some days it was just a steady rain of hats.
Of all types.
Of which they seemed to have an inexhaustible supply.
A derby, a tinsel-edged cocked, four nice feathered Scotch caps dropped now in rapid succession, followed by the bachelors themselves, who touched down gallantly on the roof of the Whitestone home, each tipping his own hat or cap as he did so. "By your leave," said Mr. Lippert, "we seek a respite." "Flying tires us," said Mr. Kane. "Though we love it," said Mr. Fuller. "Ye gods," said Mr. Kane, catching sight of the boy. "He don't look so pert," said Mr. Fuller. I have been somewhat ill," the lad said, rousing himself. "I should say so," said Mr. Kane. "'Tis a bit ripe in this country," said Mr. Fuller, pinching his nose closed. "My father was here and has promised to return," the boy said. I am trying to last." "All best wishes with that," said Mr. Lippert, raising an eyebrow. "Mind your leg there, kiddo," said Mr. Kane. Distracted by our guests, we had been remiss. The boy's left leg was now webbed to the roof by several stout new tendrils, each the width of a wrist. "Goodness," the boy said, blushing. The labor required to get him free was not insignificant, roughly equivalent to that required to uproot a tangle of blackberry roots. He bore the considerable discomfort of that procedure with a soldierly fixity of mind for one so young, letting out only a stoic grunt at each tug, and then, exhausted, fell back into that earlier state of disassociated torpor. "This father of his," said Mr. Fuller in an undertone, "long-legged fellow?" "Somewhat dolorous in aspect," said Mr. Lippert. "Tall, a bit raggedy-seeming," said Mr. Kane. "Yes," I said. "Just past him," said Mr. Fuller. "I beg your pardon," I said. "Just past him," said Mr. Kane. "Here?" Mr. Volman said incredulously. "Still here?" "Out near Bellingweather, husband father shipwright," said Mr. Lippert. "Sitting all quiet-like," said Mr. Fuller. "Just past him," said Mr. Kane.
"Toodaloo," said Mr. Fuller. "You will excuse us," said Mr. Lippert. "This is the time of night when we must rapidly circumnavigate the entire premises, hovering only inches away from that dread fence, to see which of us may come the closest, even while experiencing those nauseating effects conveyed via proximity to same."
And off they went, emitting a perfect major triad via fart noises with their mouths, sending down, as if in farewell, a rain of celebratory hats. Flared tops, Turkish house caps, kepis of various colors, a flower-bedecked straw falling rather more slowly than the rest, a lovely thing, redolent of summer.
This revelation left us dumbstruck.
Strange that the gentleman had come here in the first place. Stranger still that he lingered.
The bachelors were not entirely trustworthy.
Terrified of boredom, they were prone to pranks.
Had once convinced Mrs. Tessenbaum she was manifesting in lingerie.
After which she spent several years cowering behind a tree.
Occasionally hid tiny Mrs. Blass's dead bird parts, twigs, pebbles, and motes.
Causing her to race frantically about the premises while they hovered above, encouraging her with false suggestions to leap over fallen branches and cross narrow rivulets, which did not seem narrow to her, poor thing, but like great rushing streams.
Any assertion by the bachelors must therefore be regarded with suspicion.
Still, this was intriguing.
Merited further investigation,
I think not, the Reverend said sharply, as if intuiting our intention, then indicated with a meaning glance that he wished a confidential word.